dog is gonna have the news.
Monday, September 3rd. It's the day before Los Angeles's birthday.
Happy birthday, Los Angeles.
Do you know what birthday it is?
Let's see, 1781. So that would be super old.
238 years old.
Wow.
Older than, wait, 1781?
1781.
Not older than America. But
well,
close.
Kind of.
Older than the Constitution.
Older than the Constitution. Yeah, that's what I always like to say.
Uh-huh.
Which these days
and maybe outliving the Constitution.
Yeah,
remains to be seen.
And Hayes is not here because he always takes a full week off,
right,
to celebrate the birth of our city.
I think
it's like, yeah,
he's one of those birthday week people. He really is. And anybody who listens to this show probably knows that about him already.
Maybe he's making the full like pilgrimage that they make, you know, every year they do this walk from the San Gabriel Mission to Olvera Street. They actually, I think they still do this.
To the Zanja Madre.
Yeah.
To see how the water poured out in the original settlement.
So maybe he's making the trek all the way from, you know, Mexico.
If you're walking on Broadway in Chinatown and you see Hayes looking.
Pulling up some bricks in the.
Give him a shout out. He'll be there all week. Anyway, so we have a lot of stuff to talk about. This was actually a surprisingly packed week in LA.
Big transpo week, I
Big
would say.
Transit week,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
So right off the top, we have Santa Monica. We've talked previously about their the trials and tribulations of the scooter industry as it attempts to roll out rental scooters throughout LA County, starting in Santa Monica, where Bird launched, and Lime
hatched,
is,
maybe
where Bird hatched. Yeah. That's good. And where Lime, what does a lime do?
Squeezed.
No
squeezed
verbs are coming
in later. Well, Lime kind of squeezed into the market later.
Added
maybe.
Its
yeah.
zest.
Yeah.
So anyway, there was a bit of news earlier. We talked to Laura Nelson of the LA Times, actually when the existing rental scooter companies organized their day of protest because the Santa Monica, city government had received a recommendation to allow Lyft and Uber to be the chief rental scooter operators going forward. All other operators would not be allowed for a pilot period, despite the fact that Bird and Lime are currently operating and Uber and Lyft do not currently have any scooters deployed
yeah,
anywhere.
They have not been able to show us a scooter yet, but they're working on it, apparently. This was a crazy day because we knew this announcement was coming where they were, you know, that the original like recommendations weren't the final decision. And the planning department and this shared mobility pilot group said they would take into consideration public comment, which, as we know, Bird and Lime had their users send like millions of emails to the city and then had this protest and everything. And then they worked with the city to create this like safe riding campaign the next week. So there are these ads that popped up everywhere and like how to park your scooter. So they knew we knew that final decision was going to come out on August 30th. And it was one of these like everybody gets a trophy situation. Yeah. So they gave Bird and Lime will both be able to have 700 scooters. But then Lyft and Uber, which is all Jump technically, will also both have 250 scooters each. And in addition, Lyft and Uber / Jump will have 500 e-bikes each.
Okay.
So everybody gets to play scooters, but only Lyft and Jump will do the e-bikes. Which
are they specifically e-bikes? Or are they
Because they already have their bike share, Breeze bike share, which is owned, which is the same company as Jump. Breeze Bike Share, which is Social Bicycles, the same company as Jump. So it's actually kind of a nice little, I think it'll be a nice little configuration and being able to see nobody, the bike share doesn't get cannibalized because they already, you know, technically own the technology. Interested to see what Lyft's e-bikes will be like because they just bought Motivate, which is this big bike share operator, biggest bike share operator in the U.S., and they just launched dockless bikes for City Bike, dockless, and I think they're e-bikes. So there's all these gonna be all these interesting new things. Jump, this is the first city that Jump will be in Southern California. I rode Jump around last week in Sacramento, and it was like, butter, we need these things. Like, and the city of LA really needs to also really consider the e-bike situation, I think, and they are talking about that on the 4th this,
you know,
week.
It's interesting because we've seen, I think, now that we have a couple of months, maybe like 6 months of the e-scooters being out on city streets across the country, we've seen that in places where they've gone head-to-head, scooters and dockless bike share, scooters have proven really, really popular, even compared with the bike share systems. So I'm kind of curious. I think that this solution makes a lot of sense. It makes more sense than what seemed like Santa Monica trying to restrict the number of operators rather than the number of scooters.
San Francisco did.
Which is what San Francisco did.
Moments later, after this, you know, mm-hmm. this announcement comes out, San Francisco announces that they've not picked any of these people, yeah. many of which have their headquarters in San Francisco. And they went with two companies that have never operated in their city, Scoot and Skip.
Yeah.
Very small companies. So very interesting. Yeah.
It's like the equivalent of them like rooting for the Dodgers over the Giants. Very strange to see that happen. But my question, I wonder what's going to happen because we are going to see dockless bikes or e-bikes and scooters going head to head in Santa Monica. Uber and Lyft are going to be restricted more so than Lime and Bird in the number of scooters they can put out. So if it does turn out that scooters are more popular, more profitable, I wonder how that is sustainable politically. I wonder if there will be a little bit of pushback there. But.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, the other big argument, I think, is that is a too small of a number. 250 is quite small.
Right.
I think that's what Jump was required to launch with in San Francisco with its e-bikes. And everybody said that there's just not enough bikes. There's never been enough bikes. And I don't know, you know, how they determine when you get more. I don't know what the metric is. They said they want to prove that people are riding them and that they're following the rules. But I think I don't know. Santa Monica is pretty small, so it might not be.
Santa Monica's small. It's 9 square miles. And so if we have 750 Lime, 750 Bird, plus 500 combined for Lyft and Uber, that's 2,000. So we're talking about like 200 per square mile.
Okay.
That's pretty good.
That should be good.
But the two companies that are more restricted, I think, might be unhappy with this deal in the long term.
So yeah, people, if you want to ride a Lyft scooter, it might be harder to find one, for example. And then that would lead to maybe you choose an e-bike instead or something like that. So yeah, that will be interesting.
So we'll see how that plays out. Then we had, there was great coverage on Curbed and on Twitter. There were very good threads that people kept sending to me about Elon Musk's dugout loop to get back to the Dodgers for a second. So to cover this real quickly, because I don't know whether or not we've actually talked about it at all on
Hayes
the show.
And I did.
Oh, you did.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
You were on your week long.
I did listen to the show that day. But yeah, anyway, so there was a public meeting at Dodger Stadium, a kind of strange location to have a public environmental review kickoff meeting.
Yeah, it was almost like that was like part of it was that they wanted people to come and like just to be able to go to the stadium or something. Right. But it ended up kind of proving not a lot of people showed up, and they kept blaming it on the fact that traffic is so bad that it's too hard to get to Dodger Stadium.
This is the second time that Elon Musk has done this, right? Because he did the public meeting or the info session for his proposed Sepulveda tunnel loop that was in Bel Air or something like that. It was basically at his house.
It was at the Skirball or something like that, wasn't it?
Right around there. Yeah, it was around the corner from his house, essentially.
Right, yeah.
In the Sepulveda Pass at rush hour, just so that Elon Musk could walk in like an hour late and be like, this traffic, am I right? It's ridiculous.
Meeting's over.
Out there.
But in comparison, that meeting was packed, the Sepulveda tunnel. This one, there was only a few dozen people there.
And those were his neighbors.
And yeah, that's true.
Like
they were right
basically.
There. So it was a really, I mean, I wasn't there, but it was just looking at the pictures and the coverage and what was discussed, which was not much. It was no real new information was given. I think this is one of those meetings that for any project, you just have to have it to say that we had this meeting and the public now has this information. And then they have public comment, which included Tom LaBonge, doing a kind of like, you know, Tom LaBonge show that he always does.
And what exactly was, I remember you making a comment about him on Twitter or somebody mentioned
he had this bread. He had this like bread he was throwing at them. It's like that famous pumpkin bread made by the monastery in Hollywood. Oh, you've got to have the bread.
I haven't had it.
We're going to have like a bread tasting.
We'll make the coffee cake.
We'll have the bread, maybe some like tortillas or something as well. But he was like, I love this idea. You also need to build a tunnel to the Hollywood Bowl, like completely off topic, like just going on this other tangent. So he was excited. And then the other thing that a lot of people were commenting on, which was the same thing as a Sepulveda meeting, where there were a lot of employees of SpaceX and other companies that were there. I think there was three and one person who like clearly identified themselves as like a past employee.
Yeah.
So that was just a little strange of the ratio of people that were there.
Were actually like, members of the public.
Right. There were a couple people that were, you know, not just maybe just wanted to come and show their support anyway, you know.
But yeah. I mean, I guess I don't really imagine that in the area in Echo Park, why would you care about this? Because you could walk to Dodger Stadium anyway. You're sure as hell not going to go back to East Hollywood or K-Town in order to board this thing that's going to take 1,000 people to Dodger Stadium. So
I think what's also weird is, I mean, yeah, I guess you could be worried about tunneling impacts, which there won't really.
They said that that was something that they've said about this project, right? Yeah. That they're not going to tunnel under anybody's property.
Yeah, they're going to go right under just the roads that already exist, which they have, I guess, the, you know, right to do. And then there'll be maybe some like shafts or something that would have to come up. I mean, I can't really imagine anything else of the service, but let's talk about what those stations will look at. Like, are they going to punch through a wall at the metro stations?
At Vermont and Santa Monica, which they really should do with like a regular train.
Yes.
But that's a different story altogether. But yeah, they could just go under Sunset the whole way if Metro gives them the authority to do that.
So I guess like the other real question I have after this meeting, which nobody has really answered or we don't really know, is just, why the three station, like, you know, American Idol style, like, which one are we going to pick, you know? And I think there's a pretty clear, in my mind, there's a pretty clear answer. It's just the station that I happen to live by. But I think the Beverly, Vermont one would be the best one if they are going to choose one, because it doesn't have a direct bus connection. You know, if you can't just like step off the station and get to Dodger Stadium, which would be a good transit connection if it was open all the time, not just for games. So
it's a good way to generate hype for something that personally I still have extreme doubts will ever see the light of day. I would put the odds for this happening, the dugout loop happening, somewhere below the odds for the gondola, which I also am somewhat skeptical about, but at least that one you can actually see making measurable forward progress through the bureaucratic system.
I mean, maybe that's why nobody came, is because they just don't think it will ever happen, and they're just like, maybe everybody's wised up to, I don't know,
maybe
this idea. I don't know, to your theory. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, so my Figueroa just opened. That is our final Transpo update this week, but this is something that people that really care about transit in the city have been watching for a long time. I've written about it before, you've written about it before. It's something that was delayed. How many years did it take?
Just to give you an idea of how long this take, before I had like a job, before, you know, I was like a freelance writer back in the early 2010s, whatever you call that, I worked on like on the outreach team, I did some like writing for them to write some of the earliest like websites and public documents, right? So stuff that went to the public to just tell them what was going on. And in, so it's, and that it was already, I think like 4 or 5 years into the project. And I have since gotten married and have had two children. It still is not quite finished yet. So.
Changed careers a couple times.
We're talking like a decade.
Yeah.
And this was money that was originally funded, I think, a project that was originally funded through the CRA as part of this series of affordable housing projects that were going up along Figueroa. And they kind of pooled together some money and some grants and said, okay, if all these people are going to be moving to Figueroa, they should have a healthier, happier, easier way to get around. Let's take this street, which is very wide and very problematic, and add some real improvements that could make a difference in how people use the street. So, and also USC is at one end of it, you know, there, and the Staples Center and all these other now very thriving part of downtown. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense to try to convert some of those trips to non-car uses.
It actually seems like, if you look at the time that it was proposed, it seems like very good planning. And then it's something like, wow, we could actually have this in place by the time we have all these other attractions, like, you know, all the building that's going on there. And then it turns out to kind of like be finished like 5 years after all of that stuff is already done. It's amazing. So My Figueroa, we should say, is a series of like streetscape improvements. I was just down at the Hotel Figueroa this past weekend. I saw there are nice floating bus stops where the bus doesn't actually have to pull over to the side of the road. They can just stop in the middle of the lane. People can get on. It's a lot safer for bus riders. It makes the trip faster for people who are on the bus. There are protected bike lanes, which I've seen a lot of pictures people taking and posting on Twitter that are just like, this is not a protected bike lane if somebody's
There's literally cars parked in it all the time.
Yeah. But I think it almost like harkens back to a I think like an optimistic LA that was doing all of these kind of pedestrian and bike improvements earlier this decade, whereas we've seen a lot of that enthusiasm peter out in the past couple years. But this was a really big ambitious project, and I think was probably seen as like a model for how this could be done elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, part of this plan was that this would be this interrupted, this would be this uninterrupted network of safe, protected bike lanes that were at least, I think by now, should have been through the whole downtown area. And you can see there is maybe like a piece here, a piece there, a piece. It's still like our progress is so slow in getting to these protected lanes. And I will also say that even the vision put forth, you know, back a decade ago for these bollards and paint, which are separating lane, most cities have even moved past that and are building like completely permanent grade separated bike lanes now, or scooter slash bike lanes, whatever you would like to call them. And it's kind of like
grade separated, like they're at the level of the sidewalk.
I mean, in some places you'll see that there, it's kind of like three separations. You know, you have like a separation for sidewalk, and then you have like kind of a different part of a pavement that you know you're on a bike, or, you know, bike or scooter lane, and then the street traffic is completely different. So it looks like what I was so sad about when I wrote it, and I'm so happy it's there, and I think this is a great step forward that we need, but like it looks like we could just pull those bollards out anytime and just take this all away.
It does, you know? Doesn't
it's
it?
Like, it just made me feel like it's not a permanent part of the city, and that is a, and the bus lanes, I will say, are, if we can prove that this works, I would think maybe more people will get more on board with the bus island design, because I think this is what, but the bike lanes might be divisive for some parts of the city, even though those people are clearly wrong. But I think almost everybody gets behind the idea that we need to make our buses run more efficiently. So I'm hoping, like, it's kind of sad about the bike situation and some of the pedestrian crossings are not as great as they could be, but let's focus on this amazing bus, you know, efficiency and really great way to get a lot of people on and off the buses. So
I agree. Like this is, in some ways, this is representative of what we want to do going forward. And in some ways, it's representative of what we don't want to see going forward, especially in terms of the process and how long it takes. You had, what, 5-6 qualifying life events in the time it took them to put this out? That should, that could actually be like a measure for how long pedestrian improvement takes.
Yeah.
Alyssa's qualifying life events. I don't know if you're planning on having like many more.
I think
of
that's
those,
my story. I think that's my story for next week. But you pretty much nailed it. But yeah, I think I just really want to see this. Everybody was at this opening, and it was a really big deal. And the mayor was there, and all these, you know, everybody was saying what a great thing it is for the city. And I agree. Let's double down and not have the next one take 10 years. Let's start doing these in 1 year. I'm not even joking. Like yeah. Within 1 year, let's absolutely make this happen.
Okay, so we want to talk about Eric Garcetti, our mayor, maybe not for much longer, who knows at this point. Anyway, there was a story in the Times. Dakota Smith wrote a story about how Garcetti is using his Democratic midterm victory fund, his PAC, to collect money that he makes fundraising all over the country, and that he's then spending that money trying to get smaller Democratic hopefuls elected in various elections at different levels of government. This is doing a lot to raise his profile within the ranks of the Democratic Party itself. I'm not really sure that it is having the same effect on his name recognition nationally, but I think he's still considered a long shot for the primary nomination. But he is doing a lot to ingratiate himself and boost his profile among the people within the party that are looking for young talent like Garcetti represents. We wanted to talk a little bit about this, though, not in terms of his national ambitions, but specifically because there are some comments here in the LA Times about how this affects his term as LA mayor. Is he using his resources, is he particularly his time, to actually affect change here, or is he more focused nationally than locally at this point? One of the comments that I thought was super telling and a bit upsetting to me is that Dakota Smith talked to Yusuf Raab, who is one of the mayor's advisors, and mentioned that people bring up the homelessness crisis and that it doesn't seem like it has his full attention anymore, the mayor's full attention, that is. And Yusuf Raab said, "It's very important for the mayor to help elect people who will help LA and the rest of the country address the national homelessness crisis and tackle other pressing problems." Now, that's a non-answer that dances somewhere between offensive and just absurd in my mind, because the question specifically was not about the national homelessness crisis. It was about LA's homelessness crisis. And that is the homelessness crisis that Garcetti is tasked with doing something about. We have seen a lot of deflection of this kind, not just from Garcetti's office, but from a lot of LA politicians. It's something that we've talked about on this show a lot. LA has particular problems. They're not national problems. They're problems that are related to the decisions that get made here. And so to me, I don't know what you think, to hear that conflated with a national homelessness crisis that is somehow distinct from and or enveloping LA's own is not a good sign.
So I wrote a story earlier this year about how this group of mayors headed by Mayor Garcetti is trying to get the national government, federal government, to pay more attention to homelessness and to introduce some policy. Obviously, not a lot of that is going to happen now, even with our Congress or with our HUD secretary, who is pretty much just checked out and doesn't seem to understand like the very basic concerns that cities have around homelessness, or else he would have introduced something already.
Yep.
I guess on one hand, you could say that maybe voting more Democrats into Congress would maybe have them introduce some sweeping reform that would maybe funnel money to cities for homelessness. But to be honest, I'm not buying it as like a reason to send me these emails. You know, I get these emails, these Democratic midterm victory fund emails. I guess at some point I signed up for ericgarcetti.com emails, right. And now I've been added to this Democratic midterm victory fund list.
See, I'm jealous. I don't get these.
Oh, well, it's very easy to get them, Scott.
tell me how to get them. I would actually feel left out.
But I just noticed over the last few months the language kind of changed, like you said, and all of a sudden I'm getting emails that are like, help us flip the house, and I took a trip to Iowa, and this is what I saw. And over the last few weeks in particular, all the emails have been clearly directed to people who are not in Los Angeles, because you could sign up to win a trip to Los Angeles for a party hosted by Jimmy Kimmel.
Interesting.
So all of a sudden, it's, I mean, they can say, what they're caring about national homelessness. I don't even know. It's like, that to me, it's like, let's get people from outside of LA to sign up for this email for some reason. Yeah. But I mean, it's clearly not, it's not anything about LA, and it's not anything about our problems here. This is about coming to party with Jimmy Kimmel. There's all these like, yeah.
So when you say like, I went to Iowa and here's what I saw, like, what did he see besides a lot of,
you know, I don't
porn.
Click through.
Oh, you don't?
Well, no. But oh, I think
you're wasting this precious opportunity.
I mean, we can look at these, but it's kind of saying, it's this idea that these issues are important, and I'm, you know, talking to these leaders who are trying to get elected, maybe who have similar values as him in different places. So, but like we've laughed before about like, oh, just happening to visit, you know, these states where there are these big. Yeah. But I mean, on the other hand, maybe if you were a, you know, person who people said might run for president, to use your visibility to help flip the house is great. Yeah. Like I go for it, but getting these emails, and I'm glad they now come from the Democratic Midterm Victory Fund with a big picture of Eric Garcetti on top of it, because else I would have spammed. I didn't know about what it was, but I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with using that as this platform.
Yeah, no, so I agree with you. I think that it's not inherently bad to use the visibility that he has or is seeking to have in order to help flip seats from Republican in South Carolina or wherever else to Democrat seats. I don't think that that's by itself a bad thing, but just say that you're doing that. If that's what you're doing, don't try to make it somehow a like virtuous thing that you're doing for LA, because I think that that is, it's just a stretch, really.
And there was another story that was maybe in the AP or something where he had said that certain parts of Trump policy was preventing them from attacking homelessness. And that is absolutely not true. I mean, to
the extent that Garcetti feels like there's nothing as mayor that he can do about LA's homelessness issue, maybe he's not the person who should be mayor, you know, because there are distinct levers that the mayor has. And if he's not interested in pulling those levers, then I'm sure somebody else would. I understand. I take a very hardline stance on this kind of thing as somebody who is probably too invested in LA local governance structures. But that's what really strikes me as unpalatable about this whole thing. And there is a separate question of is the time that he's spending doing all of this fundraising meaningfully detracting from his ability to address the concerns of people who live in LA. And this article, certainly the comments from Yusuf Raab, did not do anything to make me feel convinced that that's not the case.
I mean, I guess we will see. I mean, we could go to the party with Jimmy Kimmel and see if all he does is talk about homelessness. That would maybe show.
Party with Jimmy Kimmel just sounds like, I don't know, none of this makes sense to me. But I guess if I were in Iowa and I was like dreaming about going to the coast, I was like, I could party with Jimmy.
As winter's coming, yeah, you want to get some good weather. Ride a
scooter. Was that a Game of Thrones plug? so we have some... state legislation to talk about this week. The legislature just closed its session. End of Jerry Brown's last term as governor is approaching as well. One of the big things that affects LA and a couple of other cities in LA County would be SB 905 from Senator Scott Wiener out of San Francisco. This is the 4 a.m. last call bill, and it was passed last week out of the assembly. So it is heading to the governor's desk now. This is a bill that would allow cities in the state of California to change their last call from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. They would get more discretionary authority over which businesses they were allowing to sell alcohol past 2 a.m. Currently in the state of California, that 2 a.m. last call is hard and fast. Sale of alcohol between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. is illegal. This is something that has been proposed. Wiener brought a similar bill that was wider in scope. It affected every city in LA or in California last year. That one failed. There was a previous attempt that did the same thing by Mark Leno, also out of San Francisco, in 2013.
They just really want to party in San Francisco. They're like, please.
Have really big hospitality interests there. Wiener has been kind of occasionally attacked as being in the pocket of, I don't know.
Big party.
Big strip club, yeah. I'm pretty sure, is one of the things that I've seen. So this is the most scaled back version of this law that we've seen brought forward in the state. But it is the one that actually successfully passed this year with bipartisan support. So Los Angeles, West Hollywood, Long Beach are the cities in LA County that would, under this law, if it's signed by Brown, be able to expand their alcohol sales hours.
So why just these cities? Why is it only certain cities?
The thinking here was that the scope last year of the legislation was what caused it to fail in the assembly. The assembly essentially gutted it and turned it into a bill to study the impacts of later alcohol sales hours. But it was the thinking that cities like San Diego was a big one where representatives were extremely opposed to this, did not want to be included. This bill actually has been changed now so that if it is signed, it would be a 5-year pilot program in these cities, that it would encompass those sort of study elements that would then be either expanded or canceled at the end of a 5-year period beginning in 2021. Santa Monica is not on the list. I assumed that they would be, but it's those sort of communities where they have a large hospitality industry presence, but also want people to stay out. And so that's why you don't see Santa Monica, you don't see Beverly Hills. You have cities like Palm Springs and Cathedral City that are on board with this. But it really is Wiener added in the cities that wanted to be a part of it. Long Beach was added at the request of Robert Garcia, mayor down there. So
it's not like at midnight on January 1st, all of a sudden everybody can stay out late. It still has to be passed at the local level, and cities will still have to reckon with, you know, what their rules are going to be. And
right. So a big part of this the conversation around this has been, do people have transportation options?
Yes.
Other than driving? Do people have the ability to, I think now with Lyft and Uber, that is a smaller consideration than it was in 2013 when Senator Leno tried to get this passed the first time. But still, that I think that 3-year or 2-year lead up period is intended for cities to be able to put in place transportation plans, law enforcement plans, to make sure that there's not going to be an associated
rise
in drunk driving.
I mean, it's not, this is the thing I hear the most about as far as transportation, like our, you know, transportation system shuts down, public transportation system shuts down. It's great people have Uber and Lyft, but especially for the employees that work at these places, you know, they're already staying out super late. They need a safe way to get home and a safe place to wait for the bus or the train. So if we can make that off-peak hour, you know, transit a priority as part of this when we finally launch this in LA, I think that would be amazing and serve a lot of other people as well. So if we can piggyback on this to make sure that we serve everybody, that would be awesome.
Absolutely. I do have to say that because of this story, I fell down a little rabbit hole where I found out that Mitch Englander on our city council's cousin, Adam Englander, is the head of the hospitality lobby here in LA, and his uncle is the head of the largest lobbying firm in LA. I had no idea. So
thanks. We're down to party. Yeah. LA city council is down to party.
Basically, yes. So again, Jerry Brown has until September 30th to decide whether or not he's going to sign this. And
what a way to go out. Come on.
Right.
Come on, Moonbeam.
Let's party.
Last call for Governor Moonbeam.
Wow. All right. Last call for Governor Jerry Brown. Okay.
Up next again, Sheriff's Department.
We're back to the Sheriff's Department. We had a couple weeks off, and now we're back. The Sheriff's Department is in the news because they have 5 new lawsuits. This is actually really horrible. There are 5 new lawsuits from female inmates at the Century Regional Detention Facility in Linwood, the county's only all-female detention facility and one of the largest in the U.S. And these lawsuits are related to sexual assault by a deputy that works there. He was actually arrested and put on administrative leave last year, but we're still, the deputy's name is Giancarlo Scotti, and there are still accusations that are coming in that he sexually assaulted female detainees, that he sexually harassed women, that he, in one instance, forced an inmate to perform oral sex. Really, like, horrifying things that are happening in our county's jail system. These lawsuits now represent, I would say, it's hard to say, but probably one of, I guess, the largest sources of distrust for the Sheriff's Department. This is one of their primary duties, is to oversee the operation of the county's jail system. And some of the accusers have also filed separate lawsuits saying that the Sheriff's Department itself, as an organization, is responsible for allowing these conditions to occur, which is the second part of this is that there is something called the Prison Rape Elimination Act that was passed in 2003 by Congress, and that it actually sets requirements for how county jails operate, for how inmates are processed, and all of these things are in order to reduce the ability of inmates to sexually harass and sexually assault each other, but also jail custodians and employees to harass and assault inmates. There was an audit that came out earlier this year that showed that the LA Sheriff's Department was failing almost all of the standards set by the Prison Rape Elimination Act. It was meeting standards on only 2 out of over 40 standards set by the PREA. And some of these are really just completely serious failures. So the LA Sheriff's Department is not mandating records be kept of every strip search and cavity search performed of inmates at the Century Regional Detention Facility. It is not using previous judgments that employees and contractors have committed sexual misconduct as a prohibiting factor against their hiring or promotion. And it is not even considering previous sexual harassment as a deciding factor in who is staffed at the Century Regional Detention Facility. So we have a systemic lack of accountability in the Sheriff's Department. This is something that we can say pretty
It's basically the subtext of this entire podcast. Yes,
it is. It really is. And this is all the product of reporting by Maya Lau, our former guest on this show. She has been really doggedly on this beat. So we will have presumably more information about this as these lawsuits progress. And then we'll see what happens with Giancarlo Scotti, the accused sexual assaulter. So to lighten things up the smallest amount, we have our sheriff's department and one where we throw in an extra very concerning sheriff's department story that you can just mull over in your head for the next couple days. In relation to Orange County's recent disclosure that their contractor responsible for providing call service between defendants and their attorneys, those calls were being unintentionally recorded for a period of several years.
Unintentionally?
That was, the contractor said it was, quote, human error. Somebody pressed the record button and left it on for 2 years. LA County Sheriff's Department officials, apparently there are very few contractors who actually provide these services, and the Sheriff's Department in LA is checking now to see whether or not their phone calls were also affected by this human error, which was found to also result in recorded phone calls in two counties in Florida. So that's your and one. We may.
So there's some master like switch that needs to just be turned off somewhere.
Yeah.
It's if anyone like, can find it, it's like that, you know, that button.
It's like in
flashing red.
Emperor's New Groove. Like, why does that button even exist? So the only thing it can do is cause possibly widespread civil rights violations. Maybe just don't have that button. Don't tempt yourself. Okay, so next we want to talk a bit about Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, new owner of the Los Angeles Times. He owns a number of other things in his role as far as I'm aware, the only billionaire physician on the face of the planet. I have no idea if there are any other of those.
We'll give him that. We'll give him that. Let's let's just say.
So what happened with Dr. Pat?
Well, this was covered in the LA Times as well as other places. But he owns, it's kind of complicated. He owns a company that manages hospitals,
right.
And other healthcare services.
Verity
is the name. There's all these very Silicon Valley-y names here that I don't even want to say out loud. But anyway, there's these six hospitals, the operator of these six hospitals is filing for bankruptcy. And two of the hospitals are in LA. One is also in Linwood.
Yep.
And then another is the St. Vincent Medical Center, which is close to downtown, like on 3rd Street, I think. So these are going bankrupt. And as part of what the company is saying is basically, when these companies were purchased by Dr. Pat's there's too many companies here, but basically what happened was these hospitals needed some serious investments that were not made, as very simple things like just IT overhaul and earthquake safety. And instead, investments were made in maybe not as necessary high-tech equipment and other programs that have been demonstrated to directly benefit the billionaire physician. So the story is kind of, you know, it's covered in the LA Times, of course, which is an interesting situation they now have themselves in of covering their new owner.
How do you talk about the boss?
Right. And I actually went back to see, because when he first started managing these hospitals and was planning all these overhauls and all these improvements, there was a story in the LA Times back then when he was just a stakeholder of Tronc, which had purchased the LA Times at that time, wasn't like the sole owner as he is now.
Yeah.
And there was this story about how he really hoped to improve these hospitals, which were all in very low income areas, and bring them up to these high tech standards, which we know that, you know, hospitals are not known for the best and highest tech levels of care when it comes to, simple maintenance and management of these properties. But now it kind of seems like he might have made some of the wrong decisions, and now they're going bankrupt kind of at the, you know, because of the decisions that were made.
Right. And these hospitals were, like you said, they had not been invested in. They were known to have a lot of financial distress at the point in time that he took it over. And he really sort of boisterously promised that he was going to be able to turn everything around for them. There was a quote in the LA Times from one of the SEIU, UHW, the health workers union representatives, saying they had heard messaging from him that was like, we are going to fix everything. And now the messaging is, you know, you're on your own, essentially.
And I guess that declaring bankruptcy from that same, I think, a union leader, was that declaring bankruptcy was actually kind of the worst possible outcome for the employees, you know, what they were just deciding to do, and that there were other alternatives that he was hoping that they could explore.
So why did they, do we know at this point why they did declare bankruptcy at this point, if there were other avenues that Dr. Pat could have taken?
I mean, it sounds like it just sounds like many of the promised improvements and things that actually are needed for day-to-day operations of this hospital were not made, and the money went to things that weren't necessarily going to make the hospitals perform more efficiently day-to-day. There's this one line here. It says, like, Verity was expected to pay $60 million over the last year in management fees, but most of that was deferred. Mm-hmm. So we don't really, it's seeming like the money just wasn't going to the right places, or maybe it was going to maybe more expensive state-of-the-art type improvements that just weren't helping with them do things like billing or, you know, scanning
right,
the, you know, like, basic documents or something.
The definitely unsexy business of just like running a hospital day to day, which is still necessary. And you would think, I would think that as somebody with an extensive background in the medical industry, that Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong would be intimately familiar with what it takes to keep a hospital up and running. Maybe that's unreasonable because he was not a hospital administrator at any point.
Well, and it would make me nervous if I was at the LA Times to read this story, because a lot of these similar promises are being made about the LA Times operation, like big tech upgrades in the newsroom and relocating the company to a new building that has a lot of bells and whistles,
right,
and we're investing in, you know, all these different things. So I would just hope, I would hope that maybe the LA Times is hiring a lot of people right now, and it's showing that they're making a lot of investments in the humans that are going to be able to make the paper even stronger. But I would just be wary, because if his company couldn't manage a healthcare operation, which he has a lot of background in, and he doesn't really have any background in running a newspaper.
Yeah.
Is this going to be the similar kind of thing where the investments are made in things that aren't really needed? And for example, LA Times employees had to hold a bake sale to get parking passes to be able to pay for their parking at their downtown bureau. It's something that's not being covered by the company. There are no bike racks at the LA Times office, I've heard. So these are, again, like, if you ignore the very basic things that are going to make your employees happy and be able to do their job, you know, that's a tough one. You might be risking, you might be making the investments in the wrong thing, and then you're not investing in what is going to help your employees do their job the best.
Yep. I think that is like the core question that is posed by the article in Politico a couple weeks ago, or a couple days ago, rather, that a lot of the investments that he has made in the past have tended to be those that are potentially profitable for him at some point in the future, which, you know, that's sort of, I guess, the name of the game when it comes to very, very rich people. But those types of investments are not necessarily the ones that are going to make the business the source the destination of the donations thrive and prosper. So yeah. Okay, so lastly we have Prop, Lock, and Drop It number 8. We have Proposition 8 this week. Wow, we still have 4 to go. So 3 to go. Yeah. 3 to go.
Okay, no, that's less than I thought. Okay, that's not
good. 3 to go. Proposition 8. This week we are talking about a proposition that would limit the profit margins for dialysis operators. This would limit their revenue to 115% of the cost of how much it actually costs to provide care for a patient and how much it costs to improve the healthcare staff and infrastructure at the site. So 115%, that means they're saying the profit cannot exceed 15%. These are some of the most profitable medical institutions in our country. There was a really great John Oliver segment about, I think that kind of brought a lot of this to people's notice last year, about the way that for-profit dialysis operators do operate and the amount of money that they get from governments of various sizes, including the federal government. He had an amazing stat that 1% of the federal government goes towards dialysis care, which is extraordinary. But dialysis is kidney dialysis is an essential medical treatment. The question before voters right now is, are these dialysis operators behaving in a way that is responsible, or are they pocketing exorbitant sums of money based on preying on people who have no choice, essentially? So yes on Proposition 8 would be to enact this limit on the profit margin. No on Proposition 8 would be to reject that. We have, as you might expect, on one side, labor unions who are saying that if the profit cap is put in place, then it will lead dialysis centers to actually invest in the workforce that is needed, because those sorts of hiring and things like that are not covered in the cap. So they could hire more people, they could open more centers and things like that that would not be covered by the 15% margin cap. However, then on the other hand, you have dialysis operators who are saying the exact opposite. They're saying, if this passes, we are going to fire people and close dialysis centers, and then people will have less access than they currently do to a necessary medical treatment.
All right, so what do we do on this one? Why are we making the call as voters? Why are we supposed to do this?
The legislature has tried to do a bunch of things around dialysis centers in the past, and I don't know if there's just no consensus, or if this measure just goes further than things that have been proposed it certainly goes further than what the legislature considered last year, which was to increase the amount of oversight that dialysis centers would be subject to. As a voter, does it really make sense to make this decision at the ballot box? I'm not sure. What do you think about this one?
No, this is stupid that we have to keep making these judgment or ethical calls or something for businesses that are being irresponsible potentially. I mean, it sounds to me like that the similar one as the lead paint one that got thrown out. We were supposed to be able to vote if, do you believe that these companies should pay for what they did to, as far as lead paint? And why would I have to decide that as a voter?
What are the odds that you are going to have all the context necessary to
That's why I vote for my elected official to make that decision, not me. So this is another one of those things where it's just, what a waste of time and money and people trying to win us over to why they should be paid the amount that they should be paid, or the labor unions. I mean, it's so complicated of an issue. I mean, this is a tough one for me to just even read and know what to decide.
Yeah. I mean, so to the extent that dialysis centers are preying upon their patients and are probably receiving just a ridiculous amount of money from taxpayers. That is bad. That's really bad. And there should be something done about that. I personally think that that something is a broader socialized healthcare
perhaps
mandate,
making it part of
Medicare for all, or a single payer.
What would you think? System. Single payer. Oh, wow.
That would be how I would say we tackle. Like when I
can
hear,
I vote for that.
When I hear, when I hear for profit dialysis centers are mistreating systemically their patients. I kind of just wonder, like, why are there for-profit
dialysis centers? That's a failure of the state government right there.
Centers. But I do have to say, like, given the system that we have, I don't know the economics of whether dialysis centers, which there are a couple of very large dialysis centers, it seems entirely plausible to me that maybe they just close and maintain higher profit margin centers elsewhere. I don't know. And it could go the other way, but I certainly do not feel comfortable telling people to vote one way or the other. This is something that has enormous consequences, the kind that should be handled by legislators whose job it is to know these things.
So you're saying undecided on 8, you're not sure, you're just going to leave it blank is what you're going to do. I mean, I also didn't know much about this one. I want to be able to write in, you should fix this elected official and make this so I don't have to vote on these kind of things again. Maybe I'll just write that in there. But I think this is the kind of stuff that needs to be reformed as far as, you know, what we're doing with these referendums and propositions and all this stuff. It's like, this is worthless.
Yeah. Okay, so that is LA Podcast. Thank you so much. And next week, Hayes will be back to tell us all about prehistoric
water systems.
Yeah, he'll report back. Look forward to that.
All right, see you then.
Bye.